welcome to another exciting episode of the Cabot Cove Gazette, the world's best Murder, She Wrote podcast. I'm your co-host, Bridget Keys.
And I'm TJ West.
We are talking today about season 4, episode 4, Old Habits Die Hard.
Which I have to say, I love this title. Like, in the annals of Murder, She Wrote titles, I think this is right up there.
I got lost when you said anal.
I said annals.
I know, but my brain hurt anal.
Listeners, I apologize. I know this is not the kind of uncouth behavior you're expecting from the cassette.
The other thing I was thinking was, like, the diehard part. Like, I'm just thinking of Bruce Willis now, right?
I mean, that would be, like, you know, an important intertext, right? Because when does Die Hard come out?
88. Maybe they were actually inspired by this episode. I would love to think that.
Yeah, maybe so. Yeah. But anyway, I have to say I love this episode I do love the episode, but I also love the title. It's just perfectly quippy and punny in a way that I really appreciate.
Yeah, and I thought you didn't like the pun episodes, though.
It depends on if they work.
Simon Says Color Me Dead.
It depends on if they work, though. Like, if they work. Okay. Like, this works because it's like Sister Act, like back in the habit. Like,
it is. I mean, this is basically Sister Act before Sister Act, right? Like, we even have the postulate choir singing.
Yep, we sure do.
And I swear to God, one of these ladies looks like Kathy Najimy, and that is confusing me the whole episode.
Yep, I also thought that. So I guess I should give a summary of this whole thing, right?
So yeah, so something about nuns.
Something about nuns. So Jessica, of course, visits a convent where her old school chum is the mother superior, apparently. And, you know, of Jessica bringing death in her wake, as she does, one of the nuns ends up dead, supposedly from an overdose of medicine. But Jessica, because of vibes, realizes that that's my new thing. That's my new grace note, is vibes.
Totally your new thing is, like, because of vibes.
That this is, you know, that something as nefarious is afoot. And as it turns out, as usual, she is correct that someone ended up killing her because of something that she knew and someone's life she could have ruined. So that's your summary for this episode. Bridget is still quite overcome because I said vibes again.
I don't know why this episode is already so fun, but I don't know if I'm going to be able to get through it.
I mean, while Bridget gets her composure back, I feel like I need to say that any episode that stars Eileen Brennan, who ultimately appears in a nun's habit, is worth its weight in gold. Like, I know that the moment she appears is supposed to be weighted with gravitas, but I'm also like, I can't not be conscious that it's Eileen Brennan in a nun's habit. Because she's not one of the nuns. I think that's worth pointing out.
No, but let's talk about how her first scene, because she is divinely glorious. I mean, she rolls up and gets out of this expensive car, and she's fawning all over Jessica, and she's talking 90 miles a minute, and she's the mayor's wife, and she's doing Eileen Brennan.
Yes.
And she does this whole thing about how they're very simpatico because they both understand what it's like not to be the little people. And I mean, she's amazing.
Yes, she is extremely Eileen Brennan in this role. And
you should maybe explain who that is, because there might be like one or two people who are like confused why we're so excited about somebody named Eileen Brennan.
Among many other things, Eileen Brennan is beloved among, I think there's a lot of crossover between Murder, She Wrote fandom and Clue fandom. Mm. So I suspect that if you've seen her or are cognizant of her being a star anywhere, it's in Clue. Mm-hmm. And, you know, she's sort of famous for being sort of one of those idiosyncratic actresses. Like, she's not traditionally beautiful, but she has, you know, this very raspy,
horsey voice. Horse voice. Not horsey, not like she's...
But you mean horse. Just like, you know, very, you know, gravelly is how I would describe it. In the same way I say, like, a Lauren Bacall. And, you know, she's obviously been in many, many things, but I think Clue or Murder by Death is one of her other famous roles.
Miss Hannigan. Isn't she Miss Hannigan?
I think so.
That's how I remember her.
And she's also if you watch Will and Grace, she also plays Jack's acting coach, Zandra, with a Z.
Oh, God. That is just amazing stuff.
Yeah.
Private Benjamin.
Yeah, she has a very robust and diverse filmography, like, starting back in, you know, the very early, like, right in 1960. You know, she's in The Last Picture Show, she's in, you know, lots of different things, important movies. So, it's The Sting, that's her other big role, with Robert Redford and Paul Newman. So, you know, she's a very famous actress, and so it's very fun to see her being her usual boisterous self.
TJ, she once shared an apartment with Rue McClanahan.
Oh, well, that would be, man, to be a fly on that wall. But our other big sort of co-star is also Jane Powell, who plays Mother Claire. And I really appreciate what Jane Powell brings to the role. She was obviously very famous in classic Hollywood, particularly for playing like young ingenue kind of characters, but also teeny bopper characters. She was in a lot of musicals. So, you know, and you could tell even though she's dressed in a nun's habit, which is not particularly revealing, but there's something very radiant about her face. Like she exudes this kind of like youthful charm that I think is a holdover from her days when, you know, she played these younger characters. So even though, you know, she's getting up in years, by the time she appears here, I think there's still a lot to enjoy about her performance.
Mm-hmm.
So what are your thoughts? What were some of the things that you noticed about the episode?
Yeah, now that I'm reasonably calm. Well, did we actually say what happens in the episode yet?
Yeah, I gave the summary at the top.
Okay, good. It must have been when I was unable to focus. And did you talk about legs or getting off the bus?
Because I did not talk about that.
The nun habits were not particularly revealing, which is like a gross understatement, right? Like the whole point is to cover everything up. And then I think they deliberately contrast that with legs getting off the bus. There's I think her name's Nancy, but I just kept calling her legs because the first shot is like a mini skirt and high heels and just her legs. And she's standing on the bus, like, looking at the convent. She so clearly doesn't belong. And
she's got quite a set of gams, as they would have said in the old days.
There you go. Yeah. And then I think we should talk about, well, maybe we'll just do characters first and then we'll get into, like, the nitty-gritty. But Bishop Shay.
Yes.
Who is also a very famous TV face.
Yep.
So because it's a convent, like, they're reporting to him and he's reporting to law enforcement and then filtering it all back to Jessica to do the investigating. And so when Jessica finds evidence and things, she's like going to him, which is super annoying to me. Because like, why doesn't she just get to go to the police? Because he sucks and he isn't really doing a good job of anything. But he is played by
Robert Prosky.
He is this sort of, I don't know, maybe what you were trying to say about Jane Powell, like, he's just sort of, like, likable, familiar face, right?
Avuncular is how I would describe him.
Avuncular. There you go. Yeah.
I mean, I think if people our generation know him from anything, it's from his appearance in Mrs. Doubtfire, where he plays, like, the owner of the studio, I think, or the network, or whatever it is that kind of bonds with Robin Williams' character, and, you know, kind of gives him the job as Mrs. Doubtfire. The TV host, as opposed to the nanny.
Yeah.
And you're right, you know, he is kind of, you know, this very appearance-saving kind of figure within the convent. Like, one of his primary concerns is to make sure that the reputation of the convent is not besmeared by the supposed suicide of this nun, which is why he doesn't want Jessica to really interrogate it too much further. Like, he's very insistent that they close this as quickly as possible so as to not cause any more issues.
In terms of murders that we get in Murder, She Wrote, first of all, I love this one because it's in a convent. The doors are locked at 6 p.m. Nobody in or out. And so it has to have been either a suicide or, as the bishop says, if you're saying it's not a suicide, then you're saying another nun murdered her.
Mm-hmm.
Which is like, these are pretty high stakes, right?
Right.
And then on top of that, if Sister Emily committed suicide, that's a mortal sin. She can't be buried in a Catholic cemetery. It has all these repercussions on her afterlife and on how she's buried and memorialized. And so I just feel like the stakes are incredibly high here, which I really appreciate.
Me too. Yeah. I like that, you know, there's the pieces make sense. Like, you know, sometimes that's not always Murder, She Wrote's strong suit, but I think that this episode really effectively marshals all of that to make a really compelling mystery that makes sense once it's solved.
Well, let's talk about that, because I think I might disagree with you. So, like, after Eileen Brennan first rolls up Mrs. Simpson, the mayor's wife, she and Jessica burst in on the Mother Superior, Claire, while she's talking to somebody who we learn is a PI.
Mm-hmm.
And we get a lot of it's as if they're, like, walking mid-conversation, but we actually get enough details to figure out what's going on. He's looking for a woman named Linda Stone. It was 15 years ago. The camera cuts to Eileen Brennan's face. She's like, it's very obvious, like, even though it was just incidental that she happened to walk in at this moment, it's so obvious that, like, she will be involved in this, right?
Yeah, that's true.
And then there was the whole thing about, like, she was kicked out of her home 15 years ago. And so I'm like, because she had a baby. Clearly she had a baby. Because that's how Murder, She Wrote does things. It's always about a baby.
Yep.
And in fact, that was true too. And so I just felt like it was so clear how this was all going to be solved.
Is that a bad thing?
I didn't feel like there was a lot of mystery.
Oh, well, yeah, but I mean, that's satisfying in itself, right? Like, that you know how things are going to go.
I suppose, I guess, you know, the more that you and I get deeper into this podcast, for me, it raises questions of like, am I just a very talented mystery fan who's able to piece clues together? Or are these things well written enough and that's why I'm able to solve them? Or are they poorly written and that's why I'm able to solve them? Or have I just seen Murder, She Wrote way too many times at this point?
I mean, is it a combination of all three, perhaps?
Probably.
I mean, because there is that also that interesting conversation between Brennan's character and her husband where, like, you know, I almost was like, are we in a Columbo situation where we're going to find out who did the murder, like, and then have Jessica piece it together?
That's exactly what I'm saying. Like, that gave us way more clues than we normally get, right?
That's true. And it's a very unusual stylistic choice because, you know, normally it's not that obvious.
In Murder, She Wrote, we might see two people having a conversation related to the crime and then they're not the ones who did the crime. It's some tangential thing. It's a red herring.
Right.
But I think you're right. It felt very Columbo in that, like, they're basically signposting, like,
right,
we're the people involved here. And the only red herring really was Legs Nancy. Like, what was she doing back at the convent? But she's too young to have been the person they were looking for. And so there was a little bit of intrigue there. And she also had been talking to Sister Emily that night. So she would be a logical person to have killed her, but in fact didn't.
Right.
And was actually telling her she was glad to be reunited with her.
Right. And of course, there's the ancillary plot where there's, you know, this young woman who's recently joined the convent, but her boyfriend is deeply resentful. But that didn't strike me as being a particularly, like, convincing potential motive because it wasn't really Sister Emily, like, who was really responsible exclusively for luring this woman into the convent.
I mean, I love that opening scene where he's, like, screaming at the nuns and screaming at the girl. And he's like, he's like telling the nuns, like, this is all your fault.
Yeah, for brainwashing her and, like, trying to get her away from the world.
Yeah, it's pretty intense, right? And
how does that, like, make you feel as a lapsed Catholic?
I'm not a lapsed Catholic. I am a very clearly and decidedly, with good conscience, left Catholicism for atheism Catholic.
As I said, a lapsed Catholic, but how did that make you feel?
Lapsed just sounds like I'm too lazy to go to church on Sunday. I thought it was actually really interesting. I think the brainwashing argument is really compelling. But, you know, in Murder, She Wrote fashion, they don't want to explore that too deeply.
Right.
Right? Because they don't want to turn off fans. But, I mean, what we do see then is her sneaking out to meet him.
Mm-hmm.
So it's like she's on the one hand saying, I've made this choice. This is what I want. And on the other, like, clearly hasn't made that choice yet.
Right, which we don't really get any resolution for that plot line, because all we know is that, you know, we find out that she gave her very, very elaborate and presumably expensive crucifix, although it might be cheap, like the brooch from the last episode. Who knows?
But didn't you feel like, I was like, oh, we're just rehashing the brooch again. Okay.
Yeah, it's like, so, you know, she ends up giving it to him after sneaking out through the tunnels underground.
Yeah.
So, like, I was like, so what, are they going to get together? Is she going to leave the convent a la the nun story? Like, what's going on here? Like,
I know, because that was the bit that was not tied up. It would have been really nice in the coda if they had given us some sense of what their resolution is. But again, I think because it's so controversial, they couldn't, right?
Right.
Like, either she's like, no, Billy, I'm not going to go with you. This is my vocation. Then that's pretty scandalous. And if she's like, tells the nuns she's leaving, that's also scandalous. So I feel like what we're going to get ultimately is like a Sound of Music moment where the mother superior is like, child, all of these are the choices God has given to us. You know, if God is telling you that this is right for you, then go be a wife. You know, like, I feel like that's the moment we're headed for.
Yeah, I would agree with that. And I mean, it seems like Sister Claire is a pretty understanding.
She seems pretty chill.
Yeah, I actually, like I said, I loved that character. It made me want to run out and join a convent if I thought the Mother Superior was going to be.
I used to want to join a convent so badly. I wanted to be a nun. That was such a fantasy of mine.
Even though I'm not Catholic, I wanted to be a monk.
Yeah, well, now as two queer people, can we just pause and look back on what was appealing about those lifestyles to us?
That I would have all day to read and just be in contemplation all the time.
You're a nerd.
I didn't think about the
lack of... I think I just wanted to live in a world of just women.
That checks out.
It was real gay.
Oh, no. Then I hit puberty and I was like, oh, yeah, that's not going to work.
Just reading isn't going to work?
No. Got to have the sexual stimulation. Which, I mean, I'm sure there's that too in monasteries if, you
know. Nope, we're not going there in this podcast. Nope. Shutting that down. Okay, so, you know, you said that you felt like the murder was pretty logical and et cetera, et cetera. And I don't disagree with you. But I do want to talk about how Jessica investigates because Sarah has been sneaking out and no one can figure out how because the doors are locked. Jessica's like, aha, I must study the blueprints to the convent. There must be a secret entrance or exit no one knows about.
Right. Which, I mean, if it's on the blueprints, then someone clearly knows about it.
Well, how did Jessica know there were blueprints to be studied? And why are there coincidentally just blueprints in the office?
Yeah, there are some. As I say on another of my podcasts, we have questions. Like, I think it's a good, you know, sometimes, as we've talked about, TV writing necessitates this kind of, like, going with it. Like, yep. Not pausing to be like, why would there be, you know, I have many questions. How is it that they've kept the secret from the nuns for so long? Unless, of course, the nuns are secretly in on the secret.
Yeah, so the secret is that there is an underground crypt, which presumably the nuns did know about. But what they didn't know was that the postulates, it's like a rite of passage that they go down there and they use it to sneak in and out of the convent.
So would you say that they're using the passage as a rite of passage?
I would also say, like, I am again confused about, maybe it wasn't the postulates. Maybe it was just the kids who are trapped there as orphans going to convent school. Because if you're a postulate and you're sneaking in and out of the convent, I would be like, are you sure you really want to be a nun, right? Like, this is my question to Sarah.
Right.
Shouldn't you be, like, all gung-ho and excited on your first couple of months? And then, like I would expect the older nuns to be the ones sneaking in and out. Because they're like, I've been doing this for 40 years. I'm over it, you know?
Right. No, I would imagine that it's probably the young people who it's are straight.
The school kids.
Yeah.
Because we see that there's also, like, kids who don't – there's the one kid we meet who's, like, she's in school there, and she doesn't have any parents.
Yeah.
Jessica later finds her crying in a closet.
Yes, yeah. And gets some very –
we're supposed to care about her. And
bad, very bad teen acting. It was bad. I was like, oh, can we get this character off the screen, please?
I mean, I just was annoyed by her the whole time. Even when in the first scene when she's like, say hello to Mrs. Fletcher, and she just walks away and be like, and then they're like, oh, it's because she is a disturbed child. Like, no, it's just because
she's rude.
Kids don't give a shit about saying hello to Jessica Fletcher. What? Like, why would they?
Unless they were mystery novel aficionados.
That's true. Can you imagine if Jessica Fletcher was like at the Scholastic Book Fair?
Oh my God.
Wouldn't that be like, I think my heart would explode.
I think mine would too. I used to love the Scholastic Book Fair.
Oh God, who? I mean, the Scholastic Book Fair.
Oh, and the little like onion skin paper, like the book that when they
the booklet.
Yeah, when they would distribute it, and then you would order the books on the back. Oh man.
Oh God.
And then just
those
this,
were such good days.
And then you would know when they brought in the big box from with Troll or Scholastic on the box. You were like, yes, the books are here.
Yeah.
I still have a couple of books from that age, actually.
I know. Listen, I understand that this is like an economically privileged thing we're talking about right now. Like, it's not nostalgia for everyone. But
I mean,
like,
I was dirt poor, but my parents still managed to scrape together the money to buy
your
books.
Your parents always valued you having access to books.
Oh, yeah.
I remember once in seventh grade, Mrs. Darrington called me to the front of the room and I was like, uh-oh, what's happening? And she pointed in the booklet to Roots and she was like, I think you're ready to read this. I think this would be a good one for you. And I felt so special that, like, she thought I could handle it. Nobody else could.
Yeah, I was always the kid in my high school English class who, you know, the teacher would be like, I think, you know, if there was something I really enjoyed, she's like, I think you'd like this.
Yeah.
It must be very validating for anyway, we're getting way off track, but must be very validating for teachers to see young people who actually care about learning.
This is like the last episode in the Haggis. Suddenly, this has nothing to do with the episode. But anyway, I hope that Amy, sweet little Amy, the kid crying in the convent closet, had the emotional satisfaction of getting a book from the Scholastic.
Right, I hope that too.
There you go. I brought it back to the episode. Okay, so TJ, secret pregnancies leading to murder.
Yes.
This is, how many of these have we had now in Murder,
a
She
lot.
Wrote?
In,
we've had like two with Barbara Babcock.
Right.
Like, this is such a thing now.
And I mean, in this case, like, it's not that Eileen Brennan's Mayor's Wife character is pregnant. It's that her husband got someone else pregnant. And so she's afraid that when they discover this girl, that they will, you know, expose her husband as being a philanderer.
And then he won't get elected mayor again.
Right. And so she kills the only person who knew and could identify this girl. And so, like, I mean, which, you know, I think for a woman like, you know, like Eileen Brennan's character, like, who has worked and struggled and sort of clawed their way to the top, the threat of losing that really does kind of cause you to lose your mind.
Mm-hmm. I can see that, because we're told that she was raised in the convent, so she had no family, she had no money.
She was bounced from foster home to foster home.
Mm-hmm. So being the mayor's wife would be kind of a big deal.
Yeah, and it's a sense of, it's not just that, it's a sense of identity. Like, it's not, you know, she, having lacked the sort of familial bonds that usually give us such a core sense of who we are, you know, she would be willing to do almost anything to protect that, which makes, again, you know, I know I gripe a lot about flimsy motivations, but I think this is one of the ones that makes sense to me.
Sure.
And I mean, partially because Eileen Brennan sells it so well. Even though she is in a nun's habit, which, like I said, is still...
I can't... Don't make me start laughing again, because that was a good 10 minutes of the episode we lost to that.
I mean, I... Yeah, the sight of... Yeah, it's still... It just cracks me up. I also, you know, after she is confronted by Jessica, who sort of, you know, sets the bait pretty effectively.
She actually... I think Lansbury does a really good job, too, of, like... Like, she hears her coming, and she's like, just wait... You can, like, see her talking to herself, like, just wait, just wait. And she's, like, sort of glancing over her shoulder, but she's like, don't turn around, you know. And there's nothing you can do but just wait for this person to creep up closer and closer. And it's terrifying. And I think Lansbury really sells that moment.
Yeah, I love those
ridiculous
moments.
As the habit is. The only thing that would make the habit thing funnier is if it was, like, a man in drag.
Yeah.
Like, that is the level of, like, funny that I'm feeling right now.
Yeah, I mean, just because it's... If it wouldn't be nearly as funny if it was anyone else, but, like, Eileen Brennan just... I just can't. And, of course, you know, the key part of all this is that she literally is wielding this massive syringe filled with, what is it called? Mylitol? Or,
yeah.
Some deadly...
Melitol.
Something like that.
Melitol. I don't know.
Something like that.
Something to that effect, yeah.
You know, she's gonna, like, inject it to... into Jessica. Like, it's pretty intense. And then once Jessica, like, you know, foils her, and that she then tries to do it again. It's like, so you're gonna wrestle this woman and, like, presumably cause all sorts of noise. So, you know, she's clearly very desperate at this point.
Yeah, but I mean, I'm gonna be you for a second. What does she think killing Jessica is going to accomplish? Now there's two murders.
Well, that's a good question. I mean, again, I think that if we take my understanding is that she's kind of, like, lapsed into temporary insanity. Like, she can see nothing except trying to resolve this immediate threat. And so, like, I don't think that she's thinking at this stage of what the consequences might be. It's all about just...
Well, that's usually what I say, but you say, and what do they think will happen afterward, you know?
I know, but I figured it was time to switch up our dynamic a little bit.
It is time to... Yeah, it is.
Now I'm waiting for you to
switches.
Now I'm waiting for you. We're versatile, as we say in gay slang.
You know, speaking of temporary insanity, I thought what was sort of nice was that because the question of suicide is weighing so heavily over Sister Emily's death, the church official ruling is that she had temporary insanity leading to self-harm, which therefore means, like, on a technicality, it wasn't suicide, and therefore she can still be buried and stuff, which is actually very nice of the church. But Jessica is like... listens to this and is like, that's just another way of saying suicide, and she didn't kill herself. We have to keep investigating.
Which, I mean, a number of things, like, identify the fact that it wasn't a suicide. Her note, which is a Bible verse, is actually just a photocopied...
It was a photocopy. Like, and also, like, it's clearly a font. I know we're supposed to believe it was handwritten, but, like, that is so clearly a font.
Right. The fact that the water pitcher is still full, so she couldn't have taken an overdose of the pills. You know, so there's some interesting...
How much, like, water does it take to take a pill?
Well, I guess it depends on how big the pill is. If you're talking about big horse pills, like what, you know, some medicine is, you might need a lot of water to get it all down.
Oh, no. I can't with people who take... You can't have trouble with pills.
Like, I have a lot of trouble with pills, so...
I know. Pretty much everyone in my life but me does, but that's just because I was a kid who was over-medicated as a child, so it's really easy for me.
Yeah, and you have weird hang-ups about medical stuff. But anyway, we don't need to have a... We don't need to put Bridget on the therapy couch today.
Not today, my friend. Not today. What do you think of the PI, though? We haven't even mentioned him.
If Well, so if there's one thing that's a red herring, it's that. Like, that seems like it's going to have some bearing, but it doesn't, except insofar as, like, the woman that he's looking for is the one that, you know, poses the danger. But it doesn't really, there's not much to go on. There's not much meat to that particular part of the plot, I didn't think.
I mean, they kind of, like, he's there, the first scene, it starts the plot, right? It's sort of the inciting incident of, like, here's a photo. Do you know who Linda Stone is? I'm looking for her. Her dad's about to die and wants to be reunited with her, and she's going to inherit money. And then the next time Jessica sees him, he's, like, leaving town. And he's like, oh, yeah, I made all that up. The real story is that, like, some guy's mom hired me because Linda's trying to marry her son, and she doesn't want to take all the money. Right. So it almost is like, I think it's like we're seeing the other side of the plot from Witness for the Defense, right?
Yes. So, yeah, I thought he was fine. He had kind of like a Jimmy Stewart kind of energy. So, like, that I always appreciated, but...
Yeah, he seems really likable. I think that's why I wanted to talk about him, because he seems, like, very familiar and very likable in ways that Murder, She Wrote PIs are often not. They're slimy and creepy and bad guys.
Except for Harry McGraw.
Except for Harry McGraw. And later, Charlie Garrett.
Who is, to be fair, also slimy and sort of, like, not particularly ethical, but very likable.
But, you know, he's special.
Right.
He's the one who gets to drug Jessica. No big deal.
Yes, exactly. MBD. But we like him because of vibes. That's why.
You're really on to something here. Like, I think maybe this was the discussion in the writer's room each week. Like, what's she vibing on this week, you guys?
That's TV for you, though, right? TV flourishes on vibes.
So last week we learned that one of Jessica's books is called Sanitarium of Death. I love when we get Jessica's book titles, because we so rarely do. And, like, they're famous. I want to know what they are. I am wondering if you think she's going to use this visit to write a book about a convent.
Probably. And it's also striking to me that one of her early conversations is with her publisher. She's like, I've already got the second half worked out. I'm like, you're a mystery writer. Of course you have it worked out. Like, it's a formulaic, like, genre. Like, what's to figure out?
Oh, that was another thing that didn't go anywhere. She's like, I got to finish this book, and we see one phone conversation with the publisher.
Right. She's just like,
it's like some gesturing at the fact that she has a career.
Right. It's like, I need to just enjoy this peaceful, quiet time in the convent.
Well, here's the thing, TJ. I think I've seen, you know, Marple has the one with the convent and the lesbian nuns. Nemesis?
Yes.
And then Sister Boniface is an entire series spun from Father Brown, which is about a priest, and it's a nun who investigates murder mysteries. And so at this point, I just think, like, I'm in too deep with nuns and murder mysteries. Like, I wouldn't trust this convent, is what I'm saying. Like, I'm right. Like, oh, we're going to be locked up in a convent. There's going to be some bad stuff happening.
Yeah. I mean, that's the whole premise of The Name of the Rose, too, right? So, you know, anytime you have people locked up in a place, religious or otherwise, things are going to go sideways. Look at any story by Edgar Allan Poe.
But I think people who like this episode should watch Sister Boniface. Have you seen it?
Nope.
I think you should watch it. It's cute. It's set in the 60s.
Okay. I will consider it. Which means no, but...
Which means no. But that's fine, you guys, because a year ago, TJ told me to watch Our Flag Means Death. And I refused because I thought the title sounded foreboding and I don't want to support negative TV titles or some other nonsense. And I recently discovered it and it's like the greatest show ever. So
the flag is a literal skull and crossbones, which means death. That's why it's titled Our Flag Means Death, because they're pirates.
Why do we want to watch a show about the bad guys?
Where have you been for the last 20 years of television?
I know. But it turns out they're not bad guys. They're all adorable and they're very gay and it's cute.
This is what happens when Bridget makes precipitate judgments about things she doesn't know about.
Lesson learned.
Of which I'm also guilty, so I cannot completely absolve myself of that.
Okay. So, Eileen Brennan in a habit.
Yep. Eileen Brennan back in the habit.
Okay.
Eileen Brennan breaking the habit.
The breaking the habit is better because it goes along with the diehard vibes, right? Like, now I just see her in the habit with, like, a machine gun. She's like, yippee-ki-yay, with, like, a cigarette hanging out of her mouth.
I wish she wasn't dead because I would totally write that and ask her to star in it.
So that's going to do it for this week's episode of the Cabot Cove Gazette. I'm your co-host, Bridget Keys.
And I'm TJ West.
And we really hope that you will please come back next time.
Our theme song is Reaching the Sky by Alexander Nakarada, used under Creative Commons license. You can find us on social media. We are the Cabot Cove Gazette on Facebook and at Cove Gazette on Instagram and Twitter.